I'm done. I'm leaving Penn State, and I'm going to go down as one of the biggest busts in college football history. My career didn't go the way I thought it was going to, but I'm sitting here now looking back as a returning two-time All-American, and I'm exactly where I thought I'd be, right?
Welcome to Willing to Fail. I'm your host, Peyton Bennett, as usual. Today, we got a very special guest. He has quite the resume. Not only was he a five-star recruit out of high school, he was the number one tight end coming out of high school, which transitioned as a true freshman All-American. He was also a two-time second-team All-American. After his playing days, he became the youngest Power 5 assistant coach. He is now a TV broadcaster with CBS and ESPN, and he's also a host of the Next Up podcast. With no further ado, Adam Brenneman. Welcome to the show. How are you?
So, man, I appreciate having you on. That's a great intro. I appreciate that and the research. But yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. This should be fun.
Yeah, I think your journey really encompasses like the theme of the show, being willing to fail. I feel like you've had a lot of highs and lows and a lot of adversity in your journey, like most people, but nowhere to start but the beginning. So kind of tell everybody like where you're from, what your upbringing was like, and what got you into football.
Yeah, I'm from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour and a half from State College, PA, which is in Penn State, where I ended up going. Had a great upbringing, great parents, oldest of three, a younger brother, younger sister, both Division I athletes as well. My dad played football in college. He played tight end, actually. So I grew up like wanting to be a tight end in college football. So just was kind of drawn to the game of football, but it was definitely blessed in a lot of areas of just having a great family, seeing, you know, a great marriage and seeing my parents work hard and seeing my dad, you know, have a great career in business and then, you know, had great siblings that have been very successful in their own right. So, definitely blessed, and then love that, you know, that Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area, my high school community of Cedar Cliff High School, which has been super supportive of me throughout my career.
Yeah, it's a big football area of the country for sure.
Yeah.
So you being like throughout your high school days, I'm sure, were you like just you feel like bigger and faster and stronger than most of your peers, or what gave you the advantage you think in high school?
You know, I was never super athletic or really felt like I was going to be a Division I athlete. I was not a good football player in middle school or early in high school. But I remember I had a growth spurt, became like 6'4", started to move a little bit better. And my high school head coach, Jim Cantafi, I'll never forget this, brought me into his office with my parents one day. And this was my freshman year in high school. And he said to my parents and I, if you do everything the right way and get good grades and keep training hard, like Adam will have offers from every school in the country. And I hadn't even played varsity football at this point. My high school coach, who I said, Jim Cantafio, had been around a lot of big time players, coached a lot of big time athletes. And I thought he was nuts. I'm like every school in the country, like he's clearly exaggerating. I'm like, why is he saying this? Well, sure enough, you know, fast forward a year and my first offer was Boston College and then Notre Dame and then Penn State. I mean, and then it spiraled from there. So that was the first meeting, I think, that really got me to believe in myself and believe that I could do it. And I think for a lesson for coaches almost is, and people that mentor young athletes is you don't even realize how much a conversation like that can have an impact on a young athlete's confidence and belief. Because before I believed it in myself, someone had to tell me to believe it, right? And that was the moment that I was told that I could play Division I football.
Yeah, that's last interview I did was with Shaquem Griffin, and he was telling me that like his mindset is like, if you don't believe in yourself, like the belief in others' belief in you can get you to believe in yourself. So that's kind of the same theme. So for you then, what was the recruiting process like? And did you just choose Penn State because it was closest to home, or what was your other schools you were looking at?
Yeah, I never thought I was going to go to Penn State, honestly. I grew up a Penn State fan, loved Penn State, but always wanted to do something a little bit non-traditional, go away from home. I was thinking I'd go to Ohio State or Notre Dame, or I was looking at Maryland. Took visits all over the country to a bunch of different schools, Alabama and Michigan. But really what happened is Bill O'Brien got hired as the head coach at Penn State. And when he got hired during my process, that's when the flip switched in my mind, and all of a sudden Penn State became a really good place for me to go develop and play for a coach like Bill O'Brien. But also, add on top of it that I grew up a Penn State fan and was close to home and everything, it made a ton of sense. And that's why I ended up picking Penn State. I had a Final Four that was, you know, it's fine. I actually just posted this. I committed to Penn State 10 years ago, you know, around this month, was my commitment to Penn State my junior year of high school. And I had the whole ceremony, and it was Penn State, Notre Dame, Maryland, and Ohio State. Those were my Final Four, and chose Penn State.
Exciting. So then you get to Penn State, and you're kind of like, I mean, you're the five-star recruit. You were the number one tight end, depending on where you looked. And so your expectations for yourself, I'm sure, were really high. And I think you started off great, at a good first season. Talk about kind of the struggles you went through with injuries and how kind of your first season went.
Yeah, my first season was, you know, went according to plan. I was a freshman All-American and ended up starting a bunch of games as a true freshman, you know, an 18-year-old kid, and, you know, kind of lived up to that expectation. But as I've learned in life, whenever you think things are going really well, you better be ready for something to happen and some adversity to strike. And right after my freshman year, I got hurt. I missed two seasons in a row, you know, had a surgery and had to, you know, miss those 2 years. Thought I might have been done playing football. I was, you know, I remember thinking to myself, how am I ever going to be able to play again? With the way my knee felt and the way that I was recovering, it didn't seem like a huge possibility. And, you know, I think that my challenge during that time was that during my high school recruitment and during my freshman year at Penn State, I allowed myself to really listen to the hype and everyone telling you how good you are and start to believe it, right? But when your validation comes from external people or external or credit you're getting from other people for things that that you're doing on the field, it gets you in a really high place. But then what happens when you listen to it when it's really positive is then you also listen when it's really negative. And for those 2 years, I was in a bad place. It was probably the lowest place I've been mentally in my life. And because I had all the expectation, and the newspaper headlines were talking about, is Brennan in a bust at Penn State? Will they ever be able to play? The five-star recruit who can't find the field. So it was super challenging. But I learned during that time, you know, I ended up coming back out of it and transferring to UMass. But I learned during that time that when the good things happen again, I got to remember to stay level-headed and not listen to the praise and just be the consistent same person every single day. And realize that your real self-confidence and your real belief in yourself needs to come internally from, you know, knowing who you are as a person, the work you put in, and not the external factors and validation you're getting.
Yeah, not the rat poison.
No doubt. It's completely, it is. That's what it is. It's rat poison. And it's something that so many people struggle with when they're young. It's, you see it all the time with big time quarterbacks and people that haven't yet faced adversity. You know, I'm always weary, even in like the NFL draft time, I look at guys' careers and a guy that was a 4-year starter and everything went well and ended up being all like, but hasn't yet faced a down point in his career. And I'm nervous about that guy because something bad is going to happen in the NFL, right? Someone who everything's going well for him in college, when they get to the NFL, shit will hit the fan at some point. They're going to get benched. They're going to get injured. Something is going, they're going to get traded into a team they don't want to go to. They're going to not get the deal they want. Something bad is going to happen. And if they've never faced that moment before in their career, how will they respond? It's an unknown. We don't know. I was just talking about Jaden Daniels versus Caleb Williams. I think Caleb Williams is a generational talent at quarterback. But the thing about Jaden Daniels, who I think is just as talented as Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels has been through some stuff in his career. He went to Arizona State. His 2021 year did not go well. He was not good. The guy couldn't complete a pass to save his life. Had to transfer, went and bet on himself, went to play for Brian Kelly, a tough coach, and wasn't the guaranteed starter and said, I'm going to go prove it to myself and went through that adversity. Like, that's the kind of guy I want to bet on, that I want to put the keys of my franchise, who's been through the ringer a little bit, and it hasn't always been pretty, but has found a way to get back on top.
Yeah, I think adversity is really important in character development and just being able to, like power through all that kind of stuff. So for you, your adversity, you're saying with injury, I mean, you answered pretty much my next question, which was going to be like, looking back, what did you think you learned most from that adversity? And I think you already answered that, of like not listening to the outside noise and kind of focusing on yourself. But I know that was like a long process. So who did you lean on, or what? Because I know I talked to Ryan Constantine, who tore his ACL 3 times in a row, 3 years in a row at Clemson.
Yeah.
And he was just talking about how the loneliness of, like, you go to school to be part of a football team, and then all of a sudden that's ripped away from you, and you're just kind of in this, like, solitary confinement. So for you, what was that struggle like, or what was the toughest part, you think?
Yeah, I mean, when I was hurt for those 2 years at Penn State, you know, I was still obviously part of the team on full scholarship. I was on our leadership council, I was one of the leaders of the team, but just wasn't playing, wasn't practicing. And I think the challenging part for me, I remember looking back and or thinking during the time, is like, you feel like you're bringing no value to the organization, to the team, right? That you're just a waste of a chair in the team meeting room. You're a waste of a scholarship. You're not living up to expectation because of the injury, because of what you're going through. So, you know, it was a big challenge for me. I had to really dig down deep and find things outside of football that I wanted to be part of and be interested in, and find friends outside of it. And I do think that one thing I've been blessed with, or one positive, is that in my life, in my career, I've always had things I've wanted to do outside of just play football. Like, I've always been interested in business. I've been interested in entrepreneurship, and, you know, I got my MBA when I was playing football. So, like, I always had that in me, that I knew if football never worked out that I would be okay, because I'd go follow these other passions. A lot of guys don't have that. You know, there's a lot of guys who have their full identity wrapped in it. And I've always tried to, I heard Tim Tebow say this one time when I was young, and I've always tried to live by it. It's like, football is what you do, it's not who you are. Football is who I am. Football is what I do, it's not who I am. And I've tried to live that in my life now, which has been, I've had to, because of the adversity I faced in my career.
Yeah. Okay. So you face all that adversity at Penn State, you end up graduating from Penn State, right?
Yeah.
And then talk about, like, kind of the process of deciding to continue to play football and transfer to UMass. What was that like?
Yeah. I mean, I thought I was done. I left Penn State, got my degree in 3 years. It was like, you know, my knees messed up. I'm done. I'm leaving Penn State, and I'm going to go down as one of the biggest busts in college football history, because I was a five-star recruit that had offers from everywhere and ended up only playing one season of college football. But really, my knee started to feel a little bit better the summer before I transferred. And one of my childhood best friends, still one of my best friends to this day, Andrew Ford, transferred to UMass to be the quarterback. He was my quarterback in high school. We were super close. He went to Virginia Tech, transferred to UMass. I also knew the head coach at UMass really well. His son, Austin, Mark, his head coach's name is Mark Whipple. His son, Austin Whipple, was one of my close friends at Penn State, still a close friend to this day too. So I knew his dad, Mark Whipple, new head coach at UMass. So there were some connections there that I knew the people at UMass. I knew my quarterback was going to be there. And I had some conversations and just felt like I wanted to give it another shot, but I also wanted to do it outside of the hometown school spotlight. I wanted to go place. I also knew my knee was messed up, so I couldn't practice and probably do the things I had to at Penn State. So I had to go somewhere where I could kind of be the guy and not have to practice all the time and not compete as much because of the wear and tear on my knee. So, you know, I thought about it and had some conversations, talked to Coach Franklin at Penn State, and decided I was going to transfer to UMass and give it another shot. And when I got there, it was a perfect situation. Again, I knew a lot of people. I had respect in that building. I think transferring to a place like UMass, where there's something to be said for going somewhere and kind of like being the highest rated recruit in school history. And, you know, like, it just kind of gives you some credibility and some ability to really, like, find yourself and figure out what the plan is to make sure my knee's good. And I had two really good seasons there, you know, was a 2-time All-American and led the country in receiving as a tight end, and had a lot of success, and really allowed me to sit back after my first 2 years at UMass, my 2 years there, and say, you know, my career didn't go the way I thought it was going to. There's been a lot of hiccups in the road, but I'm sitting here now looking back as a returning 2-time All-American, and I'm exactly where I thought I'd be, right, as a senior in college, which was kind of unique. I'm in a different location, but it's kind of unique to sit there and say that.
Yeah, it's cool that you're able to realize, like, your goals and your ambitions, but that's how life is. It's not the path you expected at all.
Different path. Yes. If I've learned one thing in life, man, it's that the plan that you think you have for yourself is never how it actually goes. It's good to have a plan, but just be ready for that plan to not come to fruition, because it never goes that way.
Yeah, I feel like from the outside looking in, it feels like it took, like, that kind of, like, letting go of the results, like accepting yourself, like, after you're leaving Penn State, like, all right, that was it. I'm a bust. Like, that was done. Yeah. And then so kind of gave you this freedom to, like, lower the expectations and just really be grateful for what you have at UMass. So what was that feeling in your mental state when you first get to UMass, or that first game, like when you put the pads back on, you step on the field. What was that feeling like?
Well, my first game when I went to UMass and kind of like came out of my mini retirement after Penn State was at Florida in the swamp. UMass at Florida, it was like 98 degrees and like crazy humidity. It was a challenge. Florida was, they were good that year. They had a lot of players that ended up playing in the NFL. I remember going up one-on-one with Alex Anzalone, their linebacker that's been in the NFL now for a long time. So it was a challenge. I remember thinking to myself, like, man, I am not in good enough shape to be playing right now. We actually kept pretty close in that game. I did not play well. I was not good that game, but that was my foray back into college football. But it got better from there. Obviously, you know, UMass against Florida isn't a great matchup for the first game back, but it got better from there, and I kind of got acclimated and, you know, just getting that confidence again and making some big plays and you know, proving to yourself that to myself that I can make those plays on the big stage.
So for you and your looking back at your football career, high school, Penn State, and UMass, where were you when you were having the most fun, you think, on the field?
Definitely UMass, just because I think fun comes from where you have success, right? It's hard to have fun when you're not feeling confident or not feeling yourself. So, I had fun my first year at Penn State. Christian Hackenberg, one of my best friends, was our quarterback, and with Bill O'Brien, but then Bill O'Brien left as I got hurt. And just those 2 years weren't fun for me when I was injured at Penn State. But, you know, I'm very thankful for my time at Penn State. I love Penn State. Always be home. I have my degree from Penn State. I'm super involved there in the community and the NIL program. And my company, Mercury, is very involved with Penn State. But I'll always look at UMass as the pinnacle of my career and be very thankful for the opportunity I got there. Mark Whipple, the head coach, as I talked about, took a chance on me when I was just missed two seasons in a row. No one knew how my knee was and allowed me to kind of revive my career. And now at 28 years old, I haven't played in years, is I can look back on my career, despite the fact that I didn't play in the NFL, despite that it didn't always go the way I wanted, and be very proud of what I did in college football because of my 2 years at UMass.
Yeah. So you finish up your last year at UMass, you have back-to-back seasons, like you said, as second team All-American, and you lead the country in receiving yards for tight ends. Was there any thought or trying to go to the NFL? What was your mindset of like what you wanted to do next after UMass?
Oh yeah. I mean, I wanted to go to the NFL. That was the plan. I was going to go to the NFL and play for a long time. I had my knee injury, which was still an issue when I was at UMass. I went to the Senior Bowl, went to the NFL Combine, did that whole thing, and ended up knowing that the whole time that my knee was messed up. We were trying to kind of hide it from the NFL scouts. You know, that's kind of how some of that works, is you're trying to like not let them know fully about the injury. The reality is, though, they find out everything, and found out pretty quickly that my knee was messed up. I also could barely run. It was a bad combination, and I ended up realizing after talking to a bunch of doctors, I mean, I flew all over the country with my dad and my agent, trying to see different doctors, and came to the realization that I couldn't play football anymore. So ended up, I always make jokes, like I was as close to the NFL as possible without playing in the NFL, right? I retired like a month before the draft. It's all part of a bigger plan, and you can't change your cards or dealt. It's just how you play the hand. I would have loved to play in the NFL. It was a lifelong dream of mine that I never got to do. But it's also allowed me to now be in the industry I am now and having the success I am now because I didn't have that opportunity.
Yeah, I think you're definitely on the right path, and I want to get into what you've done after that. But do you think having that injuries and like dealing with that mentally of not being able to go to the NFL, do you think that was a little bit easier to deal with after the adversity, I guess the same adversity you dealt with at Penn State?
Yeah, I think by that point I learned how to handle adversity, right? Like I knew that, you know, to some people, I mean, I still get that questions about it today. Like people are like, man, how did you handle that? You were so close to the NFL, like it could have crushed you. To be honest, I just moved on. I just started working in business and doing my own thing. And I think by that point I learned that you can't allow yourself to get too high and too low, and that the only guarantee is in life is adversity. And it's not about the adversity. Like that's not what life's about. It's about how you respond to the adversity. The great ones, people that are super successful, just find a way to respond to adversity in a positive and allow a negative to become a positive. There's a story, I've heard a lot of people talk about. It's called the story of the Chinese farmer, and I won't give you the whole detail in the story, but basically it's a story about how you know, there's a Chinese farmer, and all these things keep happening to the farmer. Like, you know, his horse breaks his leg, and then, you know, his crops get stolen, and everyone says, oh, like, I feel so bad for you, your horse broke his leg. And he said, you know, is it a bad thing? Like, it basically is the moral is, you don't actually know if a bad thing is good or bad when it happens, because you don't know how it impacts the rest of your life. Something that you think in the moment is bad may not actually be bad. It may actually be a good thing that propels you into something else or gives you an opportunity somewhere else. So I think that's what I try to remember. And when negative things that you think are negative happen, it may not actually be a negative. It may be closing a door for another reason or something that was meant to happen in your life. That was a very bad explanation of the story of the Chinese farmer. You have to listen to someone actually tell the real story, because it is pretty empowering. But that I love the kind of moral of that story and how it encompasses everyday life.
Yeah, I know that story. I love that story too. All right, so for you finish your career, the NFL door is closed, and you have these other doors that are open. You decide to go to Arizona State first to be as a grad assistant, then assistant coach. So talk me through kind of that process and what your decisions and options were right after UMass.
Yeah, it was a fun time. I mean, I got a call from Herm Edwards, who was the head coach at Arizona State, the legendary guy on television, head coach of the Jets, Eagles player. And I had played for Coach Herm when I was in high school, and he said, you want to come be a GA? So I did. I went out there, moved across the country, moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, which is an awesome place. Had a great 2 years there. Got promoted quickly, became the tight ends coach. I was the youngest coach in the country when I was there. And just learned a lot about football, about myself, about leading young men. I was a tight ends. I was 24, 25, and had a room of tight ends that were 22, 23 that I was coaching. So I learned a lot. You know, and was around really cool people. Antonio Pierce was there. He's now the Raiders head coach. Marvin Lewis, the former Bengals head coach, was on staff. So many really genius, brilliant football minds in one room. And it was one of my favorite experiences of my life. It was really, really cool. And with all the success, you know, was also a lot of lessons, and learned about just leadership and how to treat people, and it also gave me a unique perspective on the game of football that I now use a lot in my media career. It's given me credibility and credentials. I don't think there's many young people in my age of media that have played at the level I have gone through the recruiting process, but then also I've been a coach and led team meetings and coached actual players and recruited on the ground for real and can talk about it with that level of credibility. So it was an awesome experience.
Was Jaden Daniels there when you were there?
Yeah, Jaden Daniels was our quarterback. Yeah, he was there. So he got there before I got there, but then for my 2 years there, he was their quarterback.
So, yeah. I mean, with Jaden Daniels, that coaching staff, like, why do you think the success didn't translate to the field?
It's a great question. I was just looking at a list of players that were on those Arizona State teams. There's like so many, like Rashad White and Johnny Wilson, who's the Florida State receiver, and so many great players on those teams. You know, Ricky Pearsall, the Florida receiver, who was, you know, got a great year last year. I don't know the right answer to that. I think that I know that at a high level program, everything seems to click all the time, and everyone's rowing the boat in the same direction, and there's just really singing the same song to the same tune. Like, there's just a continuity in that program, and I think we missed it a little bit. I don't know why. I don't have the exact reason. But I felt like from just a culture team standpoint, we didn't quite have it. I also think that you look at all those players, like everyone was really young at that point. I mean, all those guys were freshmen and sophomores and still finding themselves. And our coaching staff was young, and it was during COVID. And then the first year out of COVID, like there was a lot of things going on. And I think it took a guy like Jaden. Like, Jaden had to leave Arizona State and go bet on himself to go find that success. I truly believe that. If he would have stayed at ASU, I don't know if it would have ever gone that well. All those guys had to go find different homes and kind of, you know, go grow as men and as players, and it's worked out for a lot of them.
Okay, so at Arizona State, at what point do you realize, like, that you don't want to keep going down the coaching world, that you want to go more, like, in the media path?
Yeah, so I, after my second year at Arizona State, the whole coaching staff got fired. So Coach Herm got fired and the rest of the staff. And you know, I was thinking, like, what do I want to do next? Do I want to get into NFL? Do I want to go be the, say, in college? Do I had a bunch of opportunities. And I also was seeing the shift of athlete-driven media and content in the space. And I felt like there wasn't really a voice for young people, for Gen Z, for millennials on social media talking about the game of football. I felt like there were some famous broadcasters and a lot of people knew, but there was a gap, right, in the industry, per se. And it was the same time that, like, Pat McAfee's killing it, and, like, all these Draymond Green, and you got J.J. Redick, and these, like, athlete-driven content. And I felt like, as I said earlier, I have a very unique perspective on the game of football, from playing, coaching, being a recruit, transferring. Like, I've seen every aspect of it and can talk about it with a lot of credibility. And that's when I went all in. I started producing videos on TikTok and Instagram. I started just posting. That was literally it. And I've learned through that the power of content and eyeballs and attention. And every single opportunity I've had in my life since that first video I posted, I'm talking business, speaking, podcasts, to investments, to anything, relationships, 98% of the time it comes from content. It comes from someone seeing a video or seeing me say something or following me on social media and reaching out because of it. Even my broadcasting stuff came from the content. It started with the content. It was like, we see your videos. Do you want to get into TV? That was a great decision I made looking back on it. It was risky because I left coaching and, you know, I'm going to build this creator network for myself and figure out a way to make money on this thing. So it was a great experience, just kind of like going all in on something with not a great plan in the future, but it's worked out super well. And now it's kind of built my business around me and my team, and co-founded a business, Mercury, and have my personal media stuff I work on, the broadcasting. It's been a really fun, I've only been like 2.5 years now in the media space.
Yeah, I mean, you got a lot of growth and an opportunity ahead of you for sure. So when you say you go all in, like, I mean, what was the reaction of, like, your parents or your support group, where you're like, you're the youngest Power 5 assistant coach and, like, the most steady traditional job, and you're like, nah, I'm just going to post videos on TikTok, actually. Like, what was the reaction to your family and friends at that point?
Yeah, I mean, they were very supportive. I did have, like, I know I said I had no plan. I did have a relatively good idea of, like, how I was going to build this and why it was going to work. The biggest thing for me was I made an investment and hired a company called Grit Player Services. Jake Miller is the founder of it and worked with them in the very beginning for the kind of the first 6 months of my content creation journey. And I'll say this confidently, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have gotten off the ground and I certainly wouldn't be where I am now. I mean, everything from they kind of worked to, like, putting together the plan and how we were going to execute on it and what kind of content we were going to do, to editing the videos, to all that kind of, to script writing, worked with me on all that. And I still work with them today on a lot of my content, but they, like, making that investment, because it wasn't cheap. It was tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars I had to take out of my own pocket to invest in that. But I wanted to hit the ground running, and I knew I needed help to do it, to, like, figure out how do I make videos? How do I create content? How do I use social media? I didn't know any of that. So that investment was the biggest leap of faith, and I had to make that personally. And once I made that investment, I had a plan, and I was willing to put money in. Like, because of that conviction I had, the people around me who know me the best knew that I wouldn't do something like that without conviction and knowing that it was going to, that I was going to will it to work out. I was going to will this thing to happen some way or another.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, when you bet on yourself, like you said, Jaden Daniels did too. It's like, when you're like, when you're fully all in, I feel like that's when you're going to see the success and you're willing to push through whatever adversity. Cause I know in the content space, there's a lot of stuff you got to get through.
100%.
So how did when the TV broadcasting opportunity came across your desk, like, were you excited about that? Was that a whole nother venture you're still continuing to explore? How do you picture that in your head? It'd be your whole, like, media journey.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was a perfect fit to get into. I mean, I can, again, talk about the game of football, and I felt like I was decent at talking on camera and could articulate it pretty well. I knew the game well, and then had the connections with the coaches to, like, get a lot of the information I needed. So, I mean, my first opportunity was with ESPN, started calling some games for them. And then we're talking, like, my first game I ever did was, like, St. Francis against Akron on ESPN Plus, some bad game. on like a Saturday at noon. But it's grown from there. It's, I mean, it's my second year calling games. I just got done my second season, and now I've done games on national television, and I know I said ESPN and CBS also work with Big Ten Network, kind of work with all the different networks. And you know, I called some games on national TV last year. I call the Army home games, which is awesome. You know, the Army West Point games. Just with, you know, those are a unique experience just for what those men and women do for our country and the commitment they made to serve our nation. So it's been awesome working with those networks and now just trying to grow in the broadcasting world and kind of do bigger, bigger games. And my goal is at some point in the next few years to, you know, when people think of big time college football games, that I'm one of those people they associate with it.
Well, I think you have a great voice for that. So I
appreciate it, man. Thank you.
And yeah, I mean, your resume at your age, I feel like there's no one else that's really competing with you or at your level in the broadcasting world. So, I mean, I feel like all the big broadcasters in football are like older people, you know? So there's a, like you said, that gap in there too. So 100%. For the projects you're working on between broadcasting, your podcast, doing like your clips of just you talking, which are your favorite or the most rewarding to you?
Yeah, I mean, I love my own personal content, but to be honest, like I like the operational part of the business. That's the part that no one really sees. Like, I mean, I'm an operator at the end of the day. I operate the media company I co-founded called Mercury. We have, you know, we have 10 plus employees and we've raised venture capital and worked with a variety of schools across the country, Penn State, Oklahoma, Kansas, Kentucky, Kansas State, Louisville, a bunch of schools. And operating that business is fun. I mean, I'm hiring and firing and dealing with our budget and working with our CEO, Porter Greedy, my other founder. And so that, like, that's rewarding to me because you get to bring a lot of other people along on the journey. You know, my own personal content's awesome and the team I have around me working on that. You know, I have a great partnership with Prize Picks, which is, you know, my biggest partnership personally. And been a great partner of mine for a year and you know, the years in the future. So it's been great. I mean, it's I love all of it, and it's kind of an ecosystem now that all kind of complements each other. And as I said, the best part is bringing people along the journey with me. But I actually think you had Jack Settlement on your show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I know Jack. So Jack's agency, Snapback Agency, represents me and a lot of my marketing deals and my Prize Picks deal and things like that. So I just thought of that when I think I saw your clip of them.
Yeah. That's what I was like most curious about is how you have your business set up. I mean, sounds like, so you said you have a team of like 10 people.
Yeah. So at Mercury, we have a team of 10 people. Now those people aren't just all working on my content. It's actually more than 10. It's including contractors, like probably closer to 20. But they're working on our, you know, that is not my content. That's our content networks with these schools, our partner creating content, production company, that whole deal. And then on my personal team that worked for me, again, it's kind of an ecosystem where my personal team also works with Mercury on things. And I am Mercury's, you know, I am a co-founder of that company. So like that is, it's all kind of intertwined. But then I have a team personally that like works on just my content. And that's a team of two, basically a manager and an editor. And then, yeah, I mean, I have a bunch of different business ventures and things like that. I love doing deals with companies where I'll maybe take equity in companies instead of taking cash and upfront payments. So, you know, it's a decent sized flywheel with a lot of different operational elements. But that's what I do day to day. When I'm not shooting content, I'm operating those businesses.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm the same way as you. Like the business side of it is another game in itself. Like
it's fun, right? Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
So for you, what are your biggest like future goals or ambitions for this whole media journey that you're on?
Yeah, I think like, you know, there's obviously financial goals for everyone in this business stuff. But for me, you know, I just said it a little bit, but I want when I, you know, in 10 years and 5 years, when people think about college football and football and like this industry, I want them to think about me and my name and what I've built and what we built with the people around me and kind of be one of the most credible voices in that industry. At the same time, I want to build my businesses, build Mercury, and I want to, you know, get it to a great place that makes that where everyone part of it, our investors, our employees, you know, my co-founders, everyone makes a lot of money and can exit it or keep operating it and ride it off into the sunset. And then build my own content, like continue to build my following and my podcasts and everything. So it's all, you know, everyone always asks me, like, what do you want to focus on? Are you a content creator? Do you want to be a broadcaster? Do you want to build your company? And I want to do all of it. I want it all. I love all of it. It all complements each other. And it's been a fun journey so far. And now I'm just focused on continuing to grow it and putting in the work.
Okay. So that was like pretty much one of my last questions, but just for me personally, I'm curious about like the business side of it. Where do you see, so right now, like you said, Prize Picks is your biggest, like I guess sponsor partner that you work with.
Partner, right?
And a lot of the money in the sports industry, just in general, is funded by the gambling, which is we've seen a huge growth in. And I think it'll continue to grow for a while. But I think when these companies get out of this, like, desperate customer acquisition point, I feel like those companies are going to pay creators a little bit less. And now we're seeing like more creator funds, like on TikTok and YouTube and Instagram, like paying the creators. We're seeing that grow. So where do you see the business in like the next 5 to 10 years? Where do you think those big revenue streams are going to come from for creators and media companies like yours?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of thoughts around the betting and sports and gaming space. I think that what we will, like, you're right, that at some point the customer acquisition cost isn't going to stay as high. I do think a lot of these companies will start to move towards retention partners and not just acquisition partners. So how do you retain customers for the sports betting world? And you know, how do you make sure that like that people keep coming back and spending on the platform, whether it's Prize Picks, DraftKings, FanDuel, BetMGM, whatever. So I do think, money is not going to dry up in sports betting. It's only going to get more and more and more. It may change the structure of it or what, you know, a lot of creators get paid for driving first time users. That's where a lot of the money comes from. It may change to getting paid to drive continuous users, things like that. And then I think that like we're seeing sports as an asset class increase in the marketing and venture capital world. Like the money is flowing into sports at an all-time high pace right now, whether it's into leagues, into media, into content. It's not stopping. And then that's where my company Mercury comes in. We built Mercury to be the premier content and media company in college sports. And we build content networks using athlete-driven media at the biggest schools in the country, at Penn State, Oklahoma. And then we get hired by a lot of athletic departments as well and collectives to produce their content. So I don't think that the content and media and athlete-driven media space is going anywhere. It's only going to enhance because the fans want to hear from the men and women who are actually on the field, not the traditional media they're used to. So I think that's where the space is going. But I do think, as you said when you asked your question, the big dollars in this space have come from gambling and sports betting and fantasy for a while, for a few years now. I don't think it's going anywhere. When you think about it, the growth of gaming is only going to continue. It's becoming more and more normalized. It's now going to become legal in more and more states. I mean, sports betting is still not legal across the U.S. So everyone's got to remember that. I mean, we're still in the beginning stages of that. It's just going to increase and enhance even more, in my opinion.
Yeah. And then the last thing, talking about sports and business, I mean, you probably know more than most of like how the NIL is affecting college football. We saw Nick Saban come out and talk about like how that kind of pushed him into retirement. It seems like a little early. I know, I'm sure you're like myself and most people where you're very pro NIL. Like obviously these athletes should be getting paid for the amount of money they bring into these schools.
Yeah.
But what do you think is the balance and how do you think it's affecting college football? And then also how do you think it can help like for your business, for Mercury, like having college athletes have their own podcast?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we built our business on, right? Like athlete-driven media and NIL. NIL now allows athletes to be part of all that stuff. So, listen, college football and college sports has its issues, right? NIL, the transfer portal, on their own, those things are great, right? NIL is great by itself. Transfer portal is great by itself. The combination of the both leads to pay-for-play inducements, things that no one wants in college sports. So there's a lot to figure out. At the same time, those sports have never been stronger. College football has never been in a better place. And it's given opportunities to players. NIL has given opportunities to players that they've never had before. When I was playing, if I was going to go tell my coach that I wanted to start a podcast, I would have got laughed out of the room. Now it's normal. Athletes want to be part of content because they're building their brand to build and execute on more NIL deals. So it's a great thing. I love NIL. I love what it's done for our athletes. What's going to end up happening is NIL is going to go in-house, if you want to say, at the universities. The universities will oversee NIL. Revenue sharing will happen with the athletes for the major sports like college football, college basketball, where the players get a cut of they get salaries from the TV revenue. And the players are going to collectively bargain and and kind of whether unionizes may not be the right word, but they're going to come together just like the NFLPA does and the Players Association. They're going to do it in college and get what the players deserve. And the fact that March Madness is going on right now and the players will, you know, like March Madness is happening. March Madness is a $1 billion event, right? Billion. And the athletes right now see $0 of that. That's not going to last very much longer. The athletes will now be getting a revenue share, I think, coming in maybe the next year or so, because it's time that happens. And college sports has been a business for the administrators, for the brands, for the media companies, for the schools, for the coaches, for so long. And it's now time that it becomes a business for the players as well.
Yeah, 100% agree. And now that was all the questions I had for you about your journey. But while I have you on here, I'm curious with your expertise. And so right now, all of these college players are making NIL money, which makes it very interesting because now they're all not as quick to jump to the NFL. It's like, I'm getting paid over $1 million a year in college. Like, no rush to go to the NFL. So what are your predictions of this NFL draft? Like, who are you really high on? I'm assuming Jaden Daniels, you're pretty high on. What other big-time prospects are you high on or are you low on?
Yeah, I love Jaden Daniels. I think I actually just filmed a video that'll come out soon saying that if I was a GM, I'd be picking Jaden Daniels over Caleb Williams. The other quarterback I think that's getting a little slept on or not getting the respect he deserves is JJ McCarthy. I think JJ McCarthy's better than Drake May in this draft. I what he's done and how he's won at Michigan, how he's taking care of the football, his arm talent. I think McCarthy's getting a bad rap because of, you know, the offense he played in and the lack of throwing the football down the field explosively. But I think JJ McCarthy could be quarterback 3 in this draft after Daniels and Caleb Williams. So it's an exciting draft. I mean, you know, you think about, you just mentioned it, NIL has changed this completely, where now you're getting older and older guys that stay in school for longer and longer because of the NIL money. So you're getting better athletes, better, more prepared players that come out. And you've also had the COVID year where players have had an extra year of eligibility for a lot of times to play. So, we're kind of getting past that after this draft class will be kind of the last year that's still relevant, but it's an exciting class. It's deep. There's a lot of great players. I think it's a good tight end class. And there's a lot of teams in the NFL that need to fill some holes on offense in this class. So I'm excited to see what happens. And the quarterback thing's the most exciting. I think everyone kind of assumes that Caleb will go number one overall, which I think does happen. Not saying it's the right call, but how it plays out at 2 through 5 in the quarterback, the quarterback dynamic will be certainly interesting.
Yeah, as a Falcons fan, I was hoping we would get someone like Jaden Daniels. I mean, now that we have Kirk Cousins, I don't think we're going to be drafting a quarterback in the first round. Yeah. Personally, I would love to see the Falcons draft a quarterback like next year, maybe in the first or second round, or a quarterback like if JJ McCarthy falls, just because I feel like a lot of NFL teams have gotten away from what the Packers do. It's like sit a guy for a couple of years and have him ready. Why do you think no NFL teams are doing that anymore?
Yeah. You know, I think, it's a win now mindset in the NFL, right? Like you have to make money, or you have to
save your
make
job,
a return on that money you're spending, right? So I think like how you build a roster, there's two ways to build a roster in the NFL. We saw it in the Super Bowl, right? The one model is pay a huge name quarterback so much freaking money that you get him long term, like Patrick Mahomes, and then build around him incrementally with some good players. The other model is the exact opposite. It's get a rookie quarterback on a rookie deal and put the best talent around him, like Christian McCaffrey and all these great players. Both can work, right? And what we're seeing is GMs continuously flip-flop back and forth on which model they want to try. But you kind of got to go in one or the other. Like getting a guy in the middle who is not a good enough quarterback to like draw a huge contract, but also isn't on a rookie deal, but you still got to pay $25 million a year to, like that model hasn't worked, right? Like you think about the quarterbacks in that middle ground. It's either get a franchise quarterback that's elite and pay them that way, and then you go and then you waste a lot of your cap space on them. I shouldn't say waste, but use a lot of it, or get a quarterback on a rookie deal. So it's interesting to see how the GMs kind of navigate that scenario.
When you follow the NFL, are you personally a fan of any NFL team or just the NFL as a whole?
I'm an Eagles fan. I live in Philadelphia, so I'm an Eagles fan, and my guy Saquon, who I played with at Penn State, now an Eagles, so I'm excited for that. But honestly, like I'm much more of a college guy than NFL. I love college football. Obviously, it's what I cover. But I bet on NFL. So there's a lot of fun in that too.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. That was all the questions I had about you and your personal journey, and it was nice to pick your brain about what we got going on in the NFL right now. What else do you have for the audience? Like, where can they find you, or what other projects and stuff do you have coming up?
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Appreciate you having me on. Follow me on social media at Adam Brenneman on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. My podcast, Next Up with Adam Brenneman. I'll be traveling around the country here in the next couple of months on a college football tour. So going to Alabama and Oregon and Washington and Auburn and Mississippi State and Penn State, interviewing their head coaches and quarterbacks and things like that. So a lot of cool content coming up. But yeah, I appreciate having me on. This is a fun time, and congrats on your success with the show.
Appreciate it. And again, thanks for coming on. I'm excited to see what interviews and content you have coming up next.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
All right. That's a show.